Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're talking about humanoid robots, lifelike robots that can move, play sports, and do work. The first ever World Humanoid Games in August in China put the technology on full display. But it's more than play that they were built for. They are being put to work around the world. Here to tell us more is Washington Post tech reporter Garrett DeVink, whose recent article is titled Humanoid Robots Were a Sci-Fi Dream. Suddenly, they're everywhere. Welcome to All Sides, Garrett.
Of course.
So the headline of your story says human-like robots were a sci-fi dream, and now, over time, we're seeing them being used in a lot of different ways. Are they really everywhere?
Yeah, not exactly everywhere. I think maybe if you're on the internet, it feels like they're everywhere. And so, yeah, I mean, of course, we've had humanoid robots in literature and TV and movies for decades. And I think people probably remember even in the late 90s, the early 2000s, robots like Honda's Osimo robot that you may have seen at a science fair or a museum. But now we have some breakthroughs, both in sort of the physical technology. So it's cheaper and easier to make strong robots that can actually stand up on their own. And with all the AI breakthroughs, like the ones behind ChatGPT, the robots can actually do more and you can interact with them in a much more seamless way.
So how has technology changed to create these robots? Tell me about them having fingers and toes, I guess... Why do they need toes, first of all? But anyway, can you talk to me about adding fingers and toes and the ability to do more human-like things?
Yeah, I mean, the whole argument behind humanoid robots, and it is an argument because some people, even in the robotic space, say, why does a robot need legs? Why does it need arms? Why does it need a head? You know, it can have wheels. It can have maybe one arm. It can have four arms. Why are we limiting robots to the human shape? And people who are behind humanoid robots say, well, the world is designed for humans. You drive a car with two arms and two legs. You operate a forklift with two arms, two legs. You pick up a baby with two arms and, you know, your two hands. And so if we want robots that can slot into the human world, help us with tasks around our homes and in our workplaces, it makes sense for them to be human shaped. And that's why there's this big push. I think it also captures the imagination. It's a lot easier to market a humanoid robot company and raise money from venture capitalists who have these ideas in their head of what the future might look like from the books that they read as kids.
Now, I watched this video of the World Games in Beijing, and it was fascinating and also a little weird. But the games in Beijing are considered a way for China to show off their robots. 16 countries participated. But what was the big point of this whole event in terms of, is it to show who's leading in this technology, to just like show off the robots?
I think that's probably the main point. And the US did send a team, Germany sent a team. So it was a pretty international affair. And I think, you know, when you look at some of the events, a lot of the robots are sort of falling over on their faces. Some of them are remote controlled by humans. So we're definitely not at the point yet where, you know, there's these completely independent, wonderfully agile robots that are able to do all the sports that humans do. But I do think that, you know, it shows the big technological race going on around the world where China, they want to show to the world, they want to show to their own people that they are moving ahead in technology and that they can do all the things that the United States can do, that they can do AI, that they can do humanoid robots. And I think the games was a way of both getting people excited. You can imagine kids watching that and saying, oh, cool, I want to be an engineer. I want to work with robots. And also you can watch, you know, you can imagine defense analysts in the Pentagon seeing that and saying, oh, okay, China's pretty serious about humanoid robots. Where is the U.S.? And so I think it's a bit of a combination.
So these humanoid robots can play soccer, They can box. They can run track. In some videos, they were doing this very well. In other videos, there was one on a soccer field where they were falling over and impeding play. And real life humans had to like grab the slumped over robots and drag them off the field. So are we not there yet? I guess these robots still have limits.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're thinking about a robot that can just generally do various tasks, we're definitely not there yet. I mean, mm-hmm. I think the soccer field, the running around the track, you know, maybe you can compare it to going to your kindergartner's sports day, right? You know, there's going to be some success, mm-hmm. but there's also going to be some tripping and some maybe even some wailing. And so I think that's sort of where we are. But I do think that if you were to go back 5 years and show roboticists some of these videos, they would say that serious progress has been made. And if you look at other tasks, such as, you know, moving boxes around in a warehouse, taking boxes off of a truck or a conveyor belt, moving them into a cart, robots can do that. They can do it quite easily. Again, it's not a complicated task, but it's something that, you know, is still difficult to get a robot to do consistently and to do it long enough that the battery doesn't run out and it's a complete waste. And so I do think there are pockets where we're starting to see places where these robots actually become economically valuable for the first time.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Washington Post tech reporter Garrett DeVink about his latest article on humanoid robots. So in your article, you described a recent Friday night in San Francisco at a robot fight club. There was a human referee. Can you tell me more about this? The Robot Fight Club. Was it much like the movie from back in the day?
Yeah. Yeah, the first Robot Fight Club is Don't Talk About It. I guess right. I'm breaking that. But I am a reporter, so that's my job. But yeah, it was very, I would say, sort of kind of kitschy and fun. It was in the basement of this kind of alternative co-working space where a lot of people who are working on, you know, weird crypto and AI startups work. And so everyone was wearing costumes. The robots were even wearing costumes, and they had this big, you know, chainmetal fence fight ring where the robots were inside boxing one another. They had a place for the robots to kind of relax afterwards and, you know, catch their breath, so to speak. So, you know, again, these robots are, you know, they're still fairly rudimentary. But I think it just shows that this is something people are excited about, especially here in San Francisco, which is really the world capital of, you know, the cutting edge of AI, pushing this technology forward. And the people in the room, they were all, you know, young people in their 20s who either, you know, work at an AI company or maybe are, you know, want to work at an AI company. And the thing that they were excited about, the thing that they were spending their time on, was humanoid robots, right? And so it felt very kind of sci-fi, futuristic, cyberpunk. And obviously the organizers were kind of leaning into that, the entertainment value there, and drawing on these ideas and motifs from science fiction. But I think, you know, it's not something that it reminded me of sort of the BattleBots maybe 10 or 15 years ago that people may remember seeing on the Discovery Channel. And it's just the next stage of that, right? And it's young people that are excited about technology and want to create and build in this new form of tech.
Well, this idea of the Robot Fight Club, it made me wonder if it's like evolving into a new novelty sport, or if this is a way for boxing to happen without humans getting hurt, or is it the next generation of gaming because these robots were controlled by humans? Is it a little bit of all three?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can imagine, you know, people paying to see a bunch of robots, you know, beat each other up, and then maybe we can start having conversations around, you know, whether we should be doing that or not. I think as the robots get better, you will see more events like this. You could call them stunts. You could call them entertainment. It's a way to get the idea that this technology is advancing out into the world and to get more people interested in it, to get more people paying attention. Because if you just see a robot at a warehouse moving a box from one pallet to another, it's not mm-hmm. quite as exciting as them, you know, going at it in a ring.
Well, you do start your piece in Oregon at an Amazon warehouse where robots are moving boxes. So is that one thing they can do well? Can they, maybe they're not great at playing soccer, but they can move boxes around?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely some of the key companies that are, I would say, furthest ahead in this technology. That's their bet. That's their argument, right? And so warehousing is obviously a huge business all over the world. Here in the United States, it's, you know, one of the biggest employers of human people all over the country. And, you know, warehousing companies will often say that they do have shortages of, you know, human work, especially now with the unemployment rate relatively low, and that people often don't want to do the job for very long. I mean, you can imagine moving a box from one pallet to another is both boring and difficult. And if you can find a different job, you might do that. And so these companies are trying to kind of come in and say, okay, what is the most boring, physically difficult job that we can get in there without necessarily being accused of pushing aside human workers? And that's where they're focusing their efforts. And so we are at a point where the robots, they can, you know, they can stand up, they can walk around, they can pick things up, they can move them. They can also, with their cameras and with some of the AI technology that we now have, if you were to say to them, pick up the boxes with a red square, they can tell which box, what is a box and which boxes have red squares on them. So they have a rudimentary form of intelligence. So you don't need to hard code them directly to do specific tasks. They can kind of come up with the solutions to some of these basic tasks on their own.
What if I want one for my house? I want Rosie from the Jetsons to clean my house for me. How far are we away from that?
I mean, you could theoretically buy a robot that could kind of sort of do that today. you might not want to trust them, you know, with anything super sensitive, carrying hot water around your house, or, you know, taking your dog for a walk, it might not come back with the dog. But yeah, I mean, there's also companies that argue, you know, warehousing is maybe not the way that people are going to start adopting these robots. It's really, if you think about some of the AI breakthroughs of ChatGPT, the technology is really social, right? People spend hours talking to ChatGPT about their personal problems. You can imagine taking ChatGPT, putting it inside a robot that looks like a teddy bear, and that's something that you suddenly have in your home. Maybe it can walk around a little bit, even if it can't do anything. If it can talk to you, you can imagine some people wanting that as a product. And there are companies that are working on robots like this that are soft, that are cuddly, that are more visually inviting, that are supposed to work with both children and elderly people as a companion. So I do think you will start to see that in people's homes. And at least companies saying, you know, this is the latest and greatest thing that you should buy.
I don't remember if it was in your article or in one of the videos I watched, but isn't there an office somewhere that has robots actually watering the plants to varying degrees of success?
Yeah, I mean, there's a company here in San Francisco called 1X, and they do essentially try to build Rosie from the Jetsons. It's a full life-sized humanoid robot. They are built less with metal and more with sort of plastics and fabrics and elastic muscles, so that they are lighter, so that if they do fall over, they don't, you know, crush someone, which is a fear and a concern with some of the more industrial humanoid robots. And so my colleague went to visit that company, and it was able to water some plants, but it spilled a lot of water on the ground. So maybe better for outdoor gardening right now than indoor gardening.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier in the interview maybe having a robot help take care of a baby or something like that. And that scared me, because I'm just picturing the robot not picking up the baby, like, with too much pressure or something. Can it feel?
Yeah, I mean, and there have been breakthroughs in terms of robots being able to feel pressure, and it's actually a really difficult problem. I mean, humans, we just learn this intuitively over our lifetimes, exactly how much pressure to apply when we pick up a brick versus a baby.
Yeah,
it's not something we need to calculate, but of course, a robot can't do that. And in the past, it would be sort of hard-coded, where an engineer would say, if you recognize a baby, only apply this much pressure, apply 100% more pressure if you recognize something more substantial. There's work on trying to sort of make the robots be able to learn that more intuitively, because an engineer can't hard code a robot for every single object in the world. It would just be not useful. Mm-hmm. But I think even if we get to the point where these robots are able to do this, you ask a really important question, which is, there's the technological capability, and then there's whether we as people will accept these robots to do these things. I mean, in San Francisco, we have self-driving taxis riding around. A lot of people are totally fine with them, but I think a lot of people may not put their child in one. Maybe they'll go for a ride themselves, but they're not quite ready to, you know, ship their kid off to school in a self-driving car, because, you know, what if something goes wrong? It's still new when you ask, you know, someone you trust to drive your kid. Obviously, you know, there's a risk there could be an accident, but you have, you know, you're used to that situation. It's something that you've done many times. You sort of have a framework for that risk. But when we have new technology, people don't know, and they don't want to give something sensitive to a robot, whether it's a car or a humanoid, just in case it does make a mistake.
We are running out of time, but I have to ask you about this figure in your story that really jumped out at me. There is a Morgan Stanley analyst who is investing a lot of money in making these robots, and they predicted that the United States could have 78 million humanoid robots in the next 25 years. That's a big number. Is that really true?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some people who say, this is all going to not really go anywhere. And then there's some people who are a lot more optimistic, a lot more bullish on it. I think it's possible. I mean, there's definitely extremely wealthy companies here in the tech industry who are spending hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars trying to make this a reality. I think it really comes down to whether the AI advances fast enough, or if AI sort of slows down and we don't see the increases in capabilities, it will be a lot harder to hit numbers like that. But, you know, I think that's just based on the fact that there's a lot of work to do, and companies are trying to automate. I mean, the whole history of the 20th century has been about automation and getting, you know, robots that aren't humanoid robots, but other kinds of robots to do things humans used to do. And so I think people see it as an extension of that.
All right. Well, I'll keep waiting for Rosie from the Jetsons to be in my house and affordable. I think that would be the key there too, right?
Yeah.
We've been talking with Washington Post tech reporter Garrett DeVink about his article, Humanoid Robots Were a Sci-Fi Dream and Suddenly They're Everywhere. Thank you so much for your time, Garrett.
Anytime.
Coming up, several Intel executives in Central Ohio are moving on, and one is heading to a healthcare startup right here in town. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're doing a local tech news roundup with Columbus Business First senior reporter Carrie Ghosh. Her beat includes technology and healthcare and financial services and Ohio State. Welcome back to All Sides, Carrie.
Thanks so much.
So you had two Intel-related items last week that I wanted to start with. Intel has had lots of ups and downs lately in the news. Their project here in Central Ohio has been delayed until at least 2030 or 2031 or maybe further. And now several key Intel employees here in Ohio have left the company. Who's leaving and why? Maybe we'll start with why.
Why is apparently they've gotten new jobs. I think the slowdown in construction has perhaps reduced the urgency of doing community events and organizing fall harvests and lobbying the Ohio legislature. Maybe their work here is done. So we'll see if any of them get backfilled. We do know that the top person, Jim Evers, who is the general manager, still on the job.
Okay.
And we do know that they plan to spend $1 billion this year on construction in New Albany, which is no small change. It's just not the entire 20 $8 billion. But they spent $7 billion so far.
Yes, they've spent a lot of money, and but they have a ways to go. So who is leaving the company? Who did you find out that is moving on from Intel?
All right. So first we have Kevin Hoggett. He had been the top lobbyist for the state of Ohio. He went to Columbus telehealth startup And Health, which was founded a couple of years ago by Matt Scantland. If listeners remember, Cover My Meds, that was acquired for $1.4 billion. Mm-hmm. And Matt took a couple years off, or a year, and he started this. Mm-hmm. And he says this is what he's been dreaming to do basically for his entire career.
Okay, we can get into we'll get into And Health in a moment, but who else is leaving
Other
Intel?
Departures. Emily Smith, in many ways, kind of the face of the project. She was a Huntington person, just very dynamic individual, and be the kind of chief spokesperson, community organizer. And hot off the presses, this is for the version going in our print on Friday, she is now senior director of community relations at nuclear power company Oklo Inc. I might be pronouncing that wrong. Mm. And then one of the members of her team, Toby Starr, he had been a public affairs manager who worked with area municipalities coordinating with Intel. He is now the director of the Johnstown Chamber of Commerce. The Johnstown is a Licking County community just to the northeast. Mm. There had been some worries back and forth about Intel's impact on small town character. And apparently it's smoothed over enough that he's now leading their business.
I was going to say he must have made some friends when his time at the site. Yeah.
His LinkedIn announcement, each one of these, they just announced it on LinkedIn. I'm so sadly stepping away from Intel with much gratitude. And each one had just outpouring of comments, and it included chamber folks and municipal folks from Johnstown who congratulated him. So apparently they knew what was coming.
Yeah.
And then we had, and this is speaks to the construction slowdown in my mind, although the company won't comment. Sanjay Patel had been the site construction manager. And he has a long career in Central Ohio. If you look at his LinkedIn, of course, none of these people responded or commented.
Right.
In construction management and safety. So his new position is director of safety for Colony Hardware, a construction equipment supplier based in Connecticut. So I don't know if this is that construction safety doesn't sound like a remote job. So we might have lost a talented person from the region. And then lastly, from what I was able to find, just being a creep on LinkedIn, was Tom Marshall. He had been the Columbus-based senior program manager for the Foundry Construction Enterprise. And Foundry is Intel's business line to make chips for other companies' designs, not just its own chips. This was a new thing under former CEO Pat Gelsinger, who, as we all know, left under pressure at the end of last year. But the new CEO says he's still committed to the Foundry model, and this New Albany complex is supposed to be a very key part of that, like building chips for Amazon, which now are being built in Arizona in the interim. And Tom Marshall, hot off the presses. Oh, no, this one I had already. Sorry. He will be the North American construction director for Vantage Data Centers. This is a company that's been building a lot of new data centers in New Albany. So not far move for him.
So I lost count there. So maybe that was six. I don't know. But these are top executives with Intel with a commitment to this build here in Central Ohio to turn Ohio into the Silicon Heartland. What are we to read into these departures? I know they're all saying lots of positive things on LinkedIn, and they're sending messages of happiness. But are we should we view it as fleeing a sinking ship?
I don't think so. And for example, my second story that you referenced was about how when the government bought a 10% stake in Intel, mm-hmm. and the mechanism of that was in part to convert the CHIPS Act into a stock buy.
Yes.
They released Intel from all obligations under this CHIPS Act agreement that they had signed just back in November, which included construction deadlines and clawback provisions. So those are all lifted. However, as a reporter, you just have to say this is what they said, and we know that this is their wish, but yeah. Governor Mike DeWine's spokesman, Dan Tierney, got on the phone with me, and he said, this company has spent $7 billion. You don't walk away from an investment like that.
Yeah.
So what we're understanding is the government has said, you got $8 billion in a CHIPS grant, and you've definitely spent $8 billion across these four states already. You're good. Mm-hmm. We know eventually you want to spend more and build these new fabs. So what are the they also lifted a provision that was in there that says no change in control, mm-hmm. Which means they have several paths ahead. So what Intel has told me so far on background is you can build the big building, the big concrete structure with the 60-foot deep concrete pad basement under it, and then not put in the more expensive part, which is the big machines that cut glass wafers, you know. So that's what they're waiting for customer demand to finish building it. Mm-hmm. The other option, sell it.
Okay.
I believe you don't build such a complex structure and then leave it to rot. I mean, I just have to believe no one wants to waste that much money.
Yeah. So either they will do something with it or they will sell it to try to make some of their $7 billion back.
And we're only speculating here, but that their current plan is to open in about 5 or 6 years.
Right. And the deadline that you had mentioned for there was $600 million in reshoring grants that the state paid. They had to spend at least $20 billion and create 3,000 jobs by December of 2028.
Right.
So obviously they're going to miss that deadline.
Right.
So do state deadlines go away when the federal government does a stock thing, or the state deadlines are still there?
In that conversation with Dan Tierney, he said, everyone is so eager to hear that we're clawing back, but what kind of economic development message is that if 2.5 years to go, we're already demanding our money back? Mm-hmm. So he said the deadline is still there. You know, if we're getting up to November of 2028, we can renegotiate. He said it's in everyone's best interest for this deal to move forward. Mm-hmm. So, both the State Department of Development and Jobs Ohio, the private economic development organization, they have this history of if companies that get these incentives are having trouble meeting their terms, they'll work with them either to renegotiate the deal, help them find whatever it is, the obstacle that they need to overcome, and only in like the most dire circumstances do they then say, okay, we're asking for our money back.
Got it. So wait till November of 2028, whoever the governor is, and we'll ask again then. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the local tech industry with Columbus Business First senior reporter Carrie Ghosh. So let's go back to And Health that mm-hmm. you mentioned. You mentioned Kevin, is it Hoggett? Hoggett?
Yeah.
Okay. Intel's top lobbyist in the state. And he was among those who announced that he was leaving Intel and has since announced that he's going to the telehealth startup called And Health. Tell me more about And Health. What is the company doing and what will his role be there?
Okay. So Matt Scantlin started this about 3.5 years ago. It is tech-enabled telehealth with real human doctors. So they start give a concrete example to help explain it. It's chronic disease reversal. So they started with migraine. Mm-hmm. There's like only 2,000 specialists neurology specialists who deal with this. So the wait lists are months and months. Mm-hmm. What they can do is get you an appointment with a specialist via telehealth in weeks or, a couple of weeks, maybe even days. Mm-hmm. You do the initial assessment. They try to find the root cause. Oh, you have an egg allergy. Oh, this person should not look at blue light before or red light before bedtime. Mm-hmm. And they find what the root causes are, get them on the right medication, get them on their dietary changes. And then there's this, rather than have to wait many more months for another appointment with that specialist, there's this team of coaches who help them, who keep checking in periodically, make sure, are you taking your medicine? Have you made your diet changes? Did you get this ergonomic chair that helps your neck in the, be mm-hmm. in the right place? They've really accomplished some remarkable results. I think some 80% in symptom reduction in the first group of patients that they had been treated. So they've since expanded into other immunologic conditions like psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, some of those things, and doing those same root cause analysis and constant feedback of coaching to get people through ways to actually deal with their condition instead right. of just waiting.
Okay. So yeah, so telehealth doesn't work for every ailment you have. If you have a broken right. arm, you need right. someone to look at that. Or if you think you have strep throat, you need to actually get the test.
These are chronic, costly conditions yeah. that are hard to deal with.
And hard to get an appointment, apparently. So yeah. is And Health, so they're located here in Columbus, but they're mm-hmm. a national company? Is this...
Not yet. They're in three states.
Okay.
So they're trying to expand kind of contiguous. It's we're in Michigan. Oh, I'm so sorry. Ohio, Indiana, Massachusetts.
Okay.
So it's kind of based on the relationships they've built. Their primary mechanism of actually getting to people now is through federal community health centers, which have an addressable market eventually of 34 million patients. They're the largest provider of primary care in the nation and historically have a hard time getting their patients' referrals to specialists get filled. Mm-hmm. So right now they're working with enough centers to reach about 500,000 patients. So
they can
grow yeah. 70-fold by working through just that population. They've also worked with large employers. They've worked with some health systems. But already they're going on about 3.5 years old. They are monthly revenue at this point is tracking for, if you multiply monthly by 12, for $100 million year in revenue, mm-hmm. which is the size that CoverMyMeds was 10 years ago. When they started the conversations for that to be acquired for $1.4 billion by McKesson a year and a half later.
Okay. Well,
Matt says, I'm not looking to sell. This right. is my very big company that I am building here in Columbus to fulfill his dream of really doing something to improve the healthcare system.
All right. So And Health will stick around and not be sold. We'll see.
So he says.
All right. We're running out of time, but there's two more quick things I wanted to get uh-huh. to that you wrote about. You wrote about the biotech industry, and we recently had a tech segment here about Ohio's growing biotech industry. You had a story on how the biotech and economic development leaders are working to train more technicians here. This mm-hmm. comes after Ohio lost out to North Carolina for a major project mm-hmm. because North Carolina had more training. So what is Ohio hoping to do to train more people in biotech?
So this is a $30 million project. They have to do a little bit of fundraising from the eventual employers. So if you look at some of the wins that have happened lately, Andelin Biosciences, if you've passed it on Lane Avenue, that's mm-hmm. been out of Nationwide Children's, Amgen building and expanding huge plant in New Albany. There's a bunch of specialty pharmacy companies. So what these have in common is they need the bunny suit workers, mm-hmm. Technicians, process operators who are specifically trained in how to work in these clean rooms and work with, living cells. And it's not necessarily a doctoral level position. You can be an associate's degree person and get this really good job, but you need the training in the technical processes for it. So they want to build a center that would have kind of the mock labs mm-hmm. Where they could do this training and then also work with your Ohio States and your Columbus States and your career and technical centers to both develop the curriculum and have little hub and spoke satellite programs for what doesn't need to be in an actual lab.
Okay. And the last tech adjacent story that you wrote about that we wanted to touch on really quickly is something that's been 4 years in the making. You had a story about Ohio State's new university hospital. Is the nearly $2 billion tower is almost complete. And they're looking to hire more than 1,000 workers, which is an eye-opening figure. I mean, that's huge. What kind of jobs are they hiring for in this big new tower?
So right now they're in the thick of hiring, just 1,000 staff, your folks who run the hospital, plus recruiting 80 physicians, about 40 other clinicians. So it's all told about 1,100. And then eventually when the whole thing is up and running, about 1,500 new jobs created at what's already the second largest, if not the largest employer in the region.
Yeah. So, When is it supposed to be open? I know they are hiring all of this.
Spring.
All right.
So the cranes are gone, but they're floor by floor have been fitting up the inside. The top floor will be the last one. And I believe that's the maternity ward. So if you go to have a baby there,
you get the best view. All right. All right. Well, when the hospital is nearer to opening, we'll have you back and you can tell us more about that building.
Awesome.
All right. We have been talking with Columbus Business First senior reporter, Carrie Ghosh. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
And coming up, we're going to talk about the Kirk assassination and how it was handled on social media. Plus, what consumers need to know about the new iPhone 17. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The video of conservative activist Charlie Kirk being fatally shot went viral almost instantly, giving viewers of all ages a gruesome and gory up-close look at murder in real time, and raising questions about why the video didn't carry a warning label and why it was allowed to continue to circulate on some platforms. Here to talk about it is Russell Hawley, the Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So I will admit, I did not see the close-up video. I saw the far-away video that aired on television, but I did not go looking for the close-up video either. But what kind of protocol, if any, do social media companies have when something like this happens and it goes online and viral immediately?
I think one of the things that we're seeing here is an example of prior protocols changing. Mm-hmm. Because the answer to that question used to be that there were content moderators that were actively monitoring, certainly for Facebook and Instagram, and I think also Threads, all owned by the same organization. And there, as early as, January of this year, Facebook made it very clear that they were changing the way that enforcement would happen, for a couple of reasons. One of the first being what they called allowing more speech on the platform, which meant that there would be fewer groups focused on moderating some of the content that was active on those platforms. Every platform is going to handle this a little differently. Twitter, for example, video is something that matters quite a bit to Twitter/X, especially as they continue to lose ground to platforms like TikTok, which we learned earlier today is not going to, go anywhere. Mm-hmm. So I think that when it comes to, how these are monitored, it's a, kind of case by case. But one of the biggest takeaways from the last 7 days certainly is that the AI tools that are supposed to be in place to handle things like this are either, not functioning as they have been described to us, or that they were never as effective as the company claimed to be, in replacing human beings doing this moderation with AI.
What about an idea of age verification? Where is there any way to prevent, you know, an 8-year-old just on YouTube from watching something like that?
This is actually harkens back to a conversation that you and I had a couple of weeks ago, where YouTube actually rolled out and is in the process of continuing to roll out age gating YouTube itself, so that if you follow a set of behaviors and YouTube believes that you are, you know, demonstrating behaviors akin to someone under 18, that you would have to verify your age directly with YouTube before they allowed you to have access to every single thing that is available on YouTube. In theory, this is something that has not yet been tested because this isn't rolled out to everything yet. Should that video have been published to YouTube, in theory, folks that were part of the age gate that YouTube is trying to set up right now would not have had access to that video.
In a column in the Washington Post, one mother, Alyssa Wright, said her 13-year-old daughter watched the video and then relayed to her mom what she had seen and sounded detached. And it made the mother worried that her daughter's becoming desensitized to violence. What about the age verification? I'm not sure where this 10-year-old watched it, but or where this 13-year-old rather watched it. But it's, I think, a classmate got around the school's ban and was watching it on TikTok at school. So what do we do about something like that? I mean, we can't protect our children from seeing this unless the video never existed in the first place.
I think we can. I think that there are tools and organizations in place to help flag things like this. Facebook and Twitter and several others have versions of programs that they call community notes, in which community members that are not paid, by the company, but are just, kind of active users, have additional tools for calling out misinformation and declaring or adding additional context to things that are shared online. Allowing some of those people to have additional tools that flag things as potentially harmful is one route that could go that would be fairly minimally invasive. But we're in a difficult position here in that a lot of these major companies that we rely on for information on a regular basis have dramatically reduced the number of people, that are monitoring this kind of content for one reason or another. Restoring some of that is the first step, but it would need to be something that was, pressured upon those companies as important for them to do, which is either going to come from consumers or, come from a government.
Yeah. Another graphic example was a recent violent stabbing of a Ukrainian woman on a North Carolina train, and it elicited a lot of alarm and concern. There's a lot of parents talking about how they're overwhelmed with the frequency and intensity of these videos. I don't know that there's a way to gatekeep. Everyone has a phone in their hand, so everything can be videoed at one point or another. Do you see this as being more in the hands of the companies, or is this a government problem? Should the government be stepping in?
I think it's going to have to be a little bit of both. I think that anytime you, engage in the idea that a government is going to kind of dictate what content is on a platform, there is always going to be people, either rightly or wrongly, who push back on that idea or claim that there are ideologies, on one side or the other that dictate what information gets shared on those platforms. At the same time, I think it should, these companies should have a financial incentive to make sure that the most vulnerable people who use their platforms don't have access to this kind of material.
Social media played an enormous role in giving Charlie Kirk his platform. How did he use it specifically in a way that how did he enable such a huge following?
Like so many others now, the model is very much to set up somewhere where you have recorded, quite a bit in the way of conversations with people in the real world, where there is a difference of opinion or a debate that is being held, almost always in a polite fashion. Kind of taking bits and pieces from those videos and either using them to further a narrative or to, spark a reaction. What we know for sure over the last couple of years, certainly, in particular, is that the kind of response, the way that people engage with things on social media is often quite polarizing. And so, you know, by being able to grab the bits of information that you think are going to get the greatest reaction, this is not exclusive to people like Charlie Kirk. We know that news organizations and even late night comedy shows mm-hmm. are doing, you know, very similar things. You know, the goal is now to grab that, you know, 10-second soundbite that gets someone's attention and starts a conversation.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. And there's no real transition from that conversation, but we'll transition into our next topic, which is we talked last week about the new iPhone 17. And we discussed the features that Apple was likely to reveal. You know, you made some predictions. So it's been a week, and I wanted to circle back and see if the predictions were true. Were there any surprises with the iPhone 17?
I think the one biggest surprise came not from the iPhone 17, but with the iPhone Air, which is something mm-hmm. we very briefly talked about because it could have been, you know, any number of things. The iPhone Air, I think, is really interesting from a marketing perspective. Apple claims that it is the thinnest phone that they have ever made, and that the body of the phone is thinner than any other phone that they have ever made. And they are able to make that claim because all of the computer parts of the phone are actually stuck up where the camera goes. So there's this bulge that doesn't count with how thick the phone is. Genuinely, they don't count how the part where the camera is. And so that's where the entire, you know, computer for the phone is there. And so the thin part of the phone is the case and the glass and the battery. And that's just about it. Which on a technical level leads quite a few people in my industry to speculate if this is the direction Apple will go in creating their first folding phone, which has been widely speculated to be released in the next 2 years. A phone that, you know, has all of the computer parts on one side, you know, so that it can fold in half, is certainly a compelling argument for Apple possibly making that decision in the next couple of years.
So I read that the iPhone 17 Pro Max is in high demand, but it's harder to tell about the iPhone Air's success. Why is the jury still out on that?
Some of that is because Apple doesn't release pre-order numbers, and we don't know how many phones, particularly for a new model, are sent to each store until they arrive, which likely isn't going to be until later this week. If you pre-ordered an iPhone this past Friday, it won't either arrive at your house or arrive at the Apple store until this coming Friday, and in some cases later. If you go on Apple's website right now and try to pre-order an iPhone 17 Pro Max, it is not going to be available on Friday. It's going to be pushed back a little bit, which either means Apple didn't make as many as they maybe should have, or more likely, it was the most popular phone and saw the most pre-orders. And so they just need to have more that will be available in the coming weeks. An interesting kind of shopping tip there. Mm-hmm. If you go onto the Apple website and the iPhone 17 Pro Max is not available, you can check with your carrier, be it AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon. They almost always have those phones in stock, even when Apple is sold out of them. So if you were a little disappointed that you weren't able to make that pre-order, or you haven't made that pre-order yet, I would check with your carrier before giving up.
Okay. But the iPhone 17 Pro Max is going to be the most popular one. Do people want the super thin iPhone Air?
I think that the super thin iPhone Air is going to appeal to folks who feel like phones are an unsightly bulge in their pockets. Or you know, don't require, you know, the latest and greatest, but want something that is visually appealing. And there's always a group of Apple fans, not just Apple, but Google, Samsung, et cetera, that, you know, like the idea of the novelty of something that is brand new. Mm-hmm. And so there will certainly be some, you know, outsized popularity for that because it is the first generation of that phone. But no, I don't think it's going to be anywhere near as popular as the 17 Pro Max.
What about cases? Every time Apple makes a new phone, all the case companies have to like follow up and make new cases because the camera shape is different, and now it's thinner, so it's going to need a different case. Are people going to be walking around with a super thin iPhone Air with no case for a while?
That's a really interesting point. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter which iPhone you go to get this generation, your your existing case, if you already have an iPhone, is not going to work on that phone. Apple will have a significant number of cases available on the day that you walk in the store to pick one up. However, so will almost every other company. In fact, you can look on Amazon right now, and a significant number of cases are already available. One really interesting caveat to that is starting last year and continuing through this year, Apple has a physical touch sensor on the side that allows you to like zoom in on things. And this mm-hmm. version of the iPhone, it's at the top of the phone. So when you turn the phone sideways, you can swipe on that with your finger in order to zoom in instead of having to touch the screen. Cases that leave that part exposed instead of having some sort of protection there, there is a chance that you could damage that sensor. And Apple's current additional repair cost for that sensor is $700.
What? That's how much the phone costs.
That is almost how much the phone costs, which is why Apple is quite common to recommend Apple Care, which is their insurance policy. Mm-hmm. Apple Care is typically available for 2 years or 3 years. And another kind of interesting shopping tip that goes along with that is that you don't actually have to buy that the day that you pick up the phone. Apple gives you up to 30 days from when you have picked up the phone to decide whether you want to pay extra for that insurance. So if you use a phone for a week or two and decide, hey, this feels like I might drop it a whole bunch, then that would be the point where that recommendation may be of value. But it's not necessarily something that everybody would need to take advantage of as soon as they walk in.
I'm going to drop it a whole bunch. I don't even have to touch anything new to know I'm going to drop
like
it a whole bunch.
Exactly the kind of person who would sign up for that.
Yes. Okay. Well, unfortunately, we ran out of time, so we're going to have to push our talk about the new AirPods and the watches to next week. But thank you so much for your time today. And Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.